today, Manpower versus Insurance Company of PA. Mr. Vickers.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel. May it please the Court. Tom Vickers. I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, plaintiff below, Manpower, Inc. We're before this Court on Manpower's appeal following the District Court's entry of final judgment in favor of the defendant, commonly referred to as ISOP, it's Insurance Company of State of Pennsylvania. Specifically, what brings us here is an appeal from and a request for the reversal of two issues or two orders that were entered by the Court below. First was the District Court's decision and orders barring Manpower's proffered damages expert, Eric Sullivan, from testifying regarding the quantum of Manpower's business interruption claim. And second is the District Court's order denying Manpower's motion for summary judgment with regard to the ISOP's third affirmative defense, what we've been calling the local policy or difference in condition issue. And it was a lengthy journey in front of the District Court, a lot of rulings, coverage rulings and others, but ultimately it's the combination of those two orders by the Court that ended the day for Manpower and the District Court and resulted in final judgment being entered in favor of ISOP. I'd like to start this morning, Your Honors, discussing the Daubert ruling, the ruling barring Eric Sullivan. As the Court is aware, there were actually two orders entered on that. The first order was the initial order on the motion in limine to bar Mr. Sullivan, docket number 132, and then there was an order entered denying a motion for reconsideration, and that's docket number 156. And in the motion for reconsideration, which the judge did consider, he didn't reject that as being unwarranted or just rehashing old events. He actually considered what we put forward. And Manpower would submit that what the District Court did in the second order abused its discretion based on this Court's holding in Smith v. Ford Motor Company. That's a 2000 case from the Seventh Circuit. In the Smith case, the District Court barred the plaintiff's...
Can I just stop you for a second for clarification then? Are you conceding that the District Court's ruling on the basis of what was originally submitted prior to the motion for reconsideration was justified?
Not at all, Your Honor. Procedurally, the way this went down, I think at the end of the day it becomes clear the basis for the Court's order was what is contrary to the holding in Smith. In the Court's original order, as I think a fair reading is, the Court recognized in response to the motion to reconsider, there was a manifest error of fact. There was a misapprehension of the facts. The Court was very clear in that first order that the methodology employed by Sullivan comported with the policy, not only in terms of following the dictates of the insurance policy and how to quantify the business interruption claim. That's an important point for this case. It's a business interruption claim under an insurance policy. The policy sets forth very specifically the formula to be applied. The Court said, done. That was followed by Sullivan, no problems there. As part of doing that analysis, he had to determine a growth rate. The Court said he used a common, simplest, most accepted method, this basic growth rate extrapolation, which, as Mr. Sullivan testified, is what he's always done and what his employer has done for over 30 years and what's common in the insurance industry. The problem with the District Court's order, though, is it said specifically that Sullivan ignored all this other data, longer periods of the historic data in determining his growth rate. When we pointed out to the Court that he didn't actually ignore that, on one of the points, the District Court even said, had he used a longer period or had he considered more data, I might have found his opinion reliable. When we pointed out, as was detailed in Sullivan's report and his deposition, that he did in fact consider all of the data, but ultimately settled on that shorter base period, then in the second order by the Court, the Court said, yes, but you don't cite to any literature in the field of forensic accounting that supports what you did. Well, on its face, it's contrary to the Court's first order, because the first order said you filed the policy, you applied what Dr. Gaughan, which, by the way, is a treatise that the Court found on his own. It wasn't presented to the Court by either party. Basic growth rate extrapolation. You followed the mandate of the policy that says you shall give due consideration to the performance of the business before the loss and the probable experience thereafter. But what I don't like is that you use this short base period, and if you looked at longer ones, I might have found it reliable. When we pointed out that he did, then what the district court did, and we think it's a very fair reading of his opinion, he said, well, yeah, okay, there's other data, you looked at it, but you haven't cited to any treatise, any principle of forensic accounting that supports selecting a short base period. Well, what Mr. Sullivan did is, and how that relates to the Smith before Motor Company is that was the abuse of discretion this court found in that case, is that the district court relied on that single factor, no peer review, and ignored everything else that had been done. And so, well, that's the abuse of discretion. And specifically, abuse is where there's a reliance on a forbidden factor, Daubert factor, or a failure to consider other essential factors. And ultimately, what the district court did in that second order is focus on that, said you didn't cite to any forensic principles or treaties, therefore it's not reliable. Not only is that an abuse of discretion by focusing on that single factor to the exclusion of the others, it's actually contrary to the evidence before the district court. There was the Gauguin reference that the court found. There was Mr. Sullivan's testimony that this is the way I've been doing this for 20 years and is the common practice in the industry and in his experience dealing with insurance companies. There is ISOP's own expert who did the same type of growth rate extrapolation. Ultimately, though, both the experts apply their judgment, the sensibility check, look at all the evidence, not just historic performance, the testimony in the case, the changes in the business, and Mr. Sullivan, applying his judgment, chose the period most proximate to the loss, which many courts have said is very relevant, and he said is very relevant, and he used that to extrapolate and use a growth rate. And we're talking about 7% growth rate.
Where are you supposed to draw the line in terms of the exercise of judgment with respect to not the baseline methodology, but the selection of the inputs that go into that methodology? If you were doing a comparison where you were using comparables to value something, I mean, you couldn't presumably reasonably value a single family residence by comparing it to the Sears Tower.
Right.
I mean, somewhere in there, there's a line to be drawn where the baseline methodology use comparables. Find the comparable period in the past to use to project the future. Mm-hmm. Becomes unreasonable. Where is that line?
Undoubtedly, there's a line, Your Honor. It wasn't in this case, considering the fact that he chose a growth rate that was less than if he had used a longer period, which was the district court's original criticism. You should have looked at a longer period. Had Mr. Sullivan did that, the growth rate would have been even higher. So absolutely, there's a line. Had Mr. Sullivan just said, well, you know what, 1 month before it was 140%, I'm going to use that, no doubt the court would have been within its discretion to say that's not reliable. But taken in totality, and ultimately this is for the fact finder to go to questions of credibility. And if somebody says it's credible, yeah, I'm going to use the Sears Tower to compare to a single family home, I would submit that would certainly be an unreliable. Under principles of appraisal, you look to comparables. But for what Mr. Sullivan did here, and really when you read all the briefing, it becomes pretty clear, it's a lot of good cross-examination. It's a lot of argument in closing, and there's questions of good instruction on the burden of proof. And Mr. Sullivan applied a methodology that was dictated by the insurance contract, number one, that is common in his industry, number two, that's similar to what ISOP's own expert applied, number three. The difference is he decided to use a growth rate that was different than what ISOP believed should have been used. That's a factual issue. That's the input. And the two district court cases we cited from the Middle District of Florida and Louisiana, which are two cases that are the most factually on point in terms of an expert in a forensic accounting situation for a business interruption claim, the same argument was made by the insurance companies in those cases about a data point, and the court said no. Data points are not basis to bar. Data points are for...
But again, you're saying that the line... You don't know where the line was, but you were clearly on the right side of it. The district court saw it differently. Our review of the district court's determination is an abuse of discretion. he drew the line in a different place than you're drawing the line. Why is that an abuse of discretion?
Because he relied on a single inappropriate factor, similar to what was done in the Smith v. Ford Motor Company case. Ultimately, what the district court said is, you haven't cited to me any principle or treatise of forensic accounting that says it's okay to look at a five-month base period. And relying on that singular factor, as the district court did in Smith v. Ford Motor Company, is the abuse of discretion. Because it clearly goes beyond, and even as late as last summer, this court in Lapsley v. Extech cautioned that the Dauber inquiry is not designed to go into the factual underpinnings. It's not to decide if the expert got it right. It's, did the expert apply a methodology that's accepted in the community? Answer here, yes. Did the expert apply a methodology that can be tested? Your Honor, in this case, their own expert took the same data, used the same analysis that Sullivan did, and came up with the same number. Did the expert apply a methodology? At some point, do they have to make judgments? Yes. Certainly, Your Honor, that's the burden that's on the district courts when doing a Daubert inquiry, is to figure out where to draw that line. Would submit in this case, when you look at the fact, as acknowledged by the district court, that the methodology employed by Mr. Sullivan was appropriate, that the method he used to select the growth rate was appropriate, but ultimately the district court didn't like the growth rate he chose.
Mr. Vickers, not questioning Mr. Sullivan's expertise.
Not at all.
I'm not raising that specter.
Yes, sir.
What would you succinctly say was the recognized professional method that he used?
To determine the growth rate? Basic growth rate extrapolation. And I have to say, Your Honor, prior to the district court finding that treatise from Dr. Galgan, that's not an expression I've ever heard in the nearly 20 years I've been doing insurance for basic growth rate extrapolation. That's what's done, but I've never heard a name put to it like that. And the reason that's done is the policy tells you that's what to do. There's a provision in the policy, experience of the business. When determining the business interruption loss, due consideration shall be given to the performance of the business before and the probable experience thereafter. It's that policy language that's been around a long time that has led to that being the common methodology that's used. You look at the history before and you extrapolate from that and look at other factors to determine the probable experience thereafter. Let's see, I'm almost out of time. If I may switch quickly to the coverage issue. Ultimately, then, once the business interruption claim was taken away by Sullivan being taken away, what Manpower was left was what's its claim for its contents, its furniture, fixtures, and fittings, about $3 million. The district court had already ruled that there was coverage for that under the master policy by virtue of the fact that the master policy's coverage grant, the perils insured is direct physical loss of or damage to insured property. There was no physical damage to Manpower's property. The parking garage adjacent to the building collapsed. If you could be transported into their space, it would look the same. That was important to the court. So now when we got down to we wanted interim judgment for that part of the claim, we had this defense of the DIC coverage. And the argument there is simply, in order to have coverage under the DIC, the coverage grant has to be broader than that under the local policy. It's very clear. The local policy requires material damage to insured property. Those are the words in the policy, material damage, whether defined as we have as physical damage or just material damage, it requires damage, material damage. There's nothing ambiguous about the word damage. And I know the district court went to a dictionary to try to assert that somehow something that's not physically altered can be damaged, but that was critical.
If that's the case, why does the policy then go on to have a lengthy list of exclusions that includes a significant number of items of loss that don't involve physical damage? Why would those need to be excluded expressly if they are excluded by virtue of the fact that the policy only covers physical damage?
Sure, Judge, and common in insurance policies, you'll have a long list of standard exclusions that are always thrown in there. That is what the district court went to. It said, well, excludes theft. However, the Seventh Circuit in the Continental v. Pittsburgh Corning case addressed that. Judge Posner's opinion made clear that one of the principles of insurance policy interpretation is you can't use an exclusion to create coverage in the first place. We never get to the exclusions because we don't have material damage to insured property. As Judge Posner said in that case, insurance policy interpretation, like other legal methodologies, is at bottom a practical art. What we have here is a local policy that was issued by an AIG insurance company, and then a master policy. One important point in the DIC provision, the last two paragraphs of that provision make clear that the only time the DIC question gets raised is if the local policy is issued by an AIG entity. If the local policy is issued by not an AIG entity, then you never have a DIC. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rakers. Ms. Bacall-Kaplan.
Good morning. I'm Emily Bacall-Kaplan on behalf of ISOP. For the reasons that are set forth in ISOP's appeal brief and the comprehensive record in this case, we ask that the panel affirm all four of the orders that are at issue on this appeal. At the outset, I just want to make a few preliminary comments about Manpower's appeal that we would like to underscore to the court. The first issue is that in its appeal brief, Manpower has made numerous assertions that have no record citations whatever. Or if there is a record citation, it's a very general or broad record citation, and if the panel were to look at that evidence, it would find that it does not in any way support the assertion being made. These statements should be stricken from the appellate record or at the least afforded no weight by this court. And just a few examples of those. If you look on page 12 of Manpower's reply brief, there's a whole litany of what they're saying are statements that are taken from the record. There are no record citations at all, none. On pages 2 through 5 of its reply memorandum, it lists a long string of information by bullet points that is actually lifted from its motion for reconsideration. And for most of those bullet points, it refers to D-138-2, which is a 31-page compilation of Mr. Sullivan's deposition testimony without any specific page or line reference to that testimony. And if you look at it, it doesn't support the propositions that are being asserted there. Manpower has taken considerable liberties in its appeal brief, as it did on the motions below, in its attempts to resurrect Mr. Sullivan as its expert, and we just wanted the court to be aware of this. And the second issue I think the court already picked up on, as I could tell from its questions of Mr. Vickers, is that in its appeal, what Manpower is asking this panel to do is to vacate a Daubert order based on a record as it existed a year after the Daubert order was decided, not on what the record was when Judge Adelman made that Daubert ruling. So Manpower throws in a whole bunch of new theories and new evidence, which, again, is not supported in the record. That's that pages 2 through 5 of its reply brief that was not in Mr. Sullivan's May 2009 report, was not supported anywhere in his deposition testimony. And we would just request that the panel take note of that when it reviews whether Judge Adelman in any way abused his discretion in excluding Mr. Sullivan's report and his testimony. Now, a few words about methodology, as we're trying to use that term here. It's a very broad term. And yes, growth rate extrapolation is a methodology. It is a methodology that was not mentioned in Mr. Sullivan's report. It was not mentioned by Mr. Sullivan in his deposition, and it was not mentioned by Mr. Sullivan in his affidavit in opposition to the Daubert motion. The first time that methodology was mentioned, it was brought up by Judge Adelman, who was trying to, I guess, grasp for some rational basis for what Mr. Sullivan did. And in theory, yes, Mr. Sullivan did come up with a growth rate extrapolation, but he didn't use any method to get there. He provided no explanation in his very cursory report for why that five-month base period was selected and why all the other base periods were excluded. He gave no explanation for assuming that growth rate that was present during that five-month pre-loss period would continue linearly for 14 months into the future. He gave no explanation at all that the reason he chose that growth rate was because it seemed to reflect the management changes. He doesn't discuss management changes in his report. He doesn't discuss any conversations he had with management with regard to the management changes and what effect those management changes would have.
But that does come in the motion for reconsideration. Let's assume, for the sake of my question, that everything that ultimately gets put before Judge Edelman on behalf of the expert is in play. Then the fundamental question I have is the same one I had for counsel, which is why, I mean, how do you square your position with Smith v. Ford, which seems to draw a line between the choice of the basic methodology here, this growth extrapolation, and the selection of inputs that go into employing that methodology, mm-hmm. which the selection of the appropriate period to use seems to fall into that bucket. So why does Smith v. Ford not control that? Why isn't that the selection of an input that, according to Smith v. Ford, is an issue for the trier of fact and an issue for cross-examination, as opposed to an indictment of the basic underlying methodology?
Well, I have two aspects of a response to that. The first is that the growth rate extrapolation was really only one feature of the calculation of the business interruption loss, and that had a lot of subparts to it that required methodology and principles and guidelines and explanations to it, none of which were ever articulated by Mr. Sullivan, even on the motion for reconsideration and even on this appeal. The Smith case is very different because there were two experts in that case, automotive experts, I believe, and the court basically said that they were not qualified to give opinions on the ultimate issue in that case. And this circuit court basically said, okay, maybe they're not qualified to give opinions on the ultimate issue in the case, but they can give their opinions on some interim issues along the way. They're qualified to do that. And what the court found when they reversed is that the trial court there really just focused on peer review. And that is it. And we don't have a situation like that here where Judge Edelman has focused on only one particular Daubert factor or Rule 702 factor.
Mr. Vickers says exactly the opposite. Why is he wrong?
I understand that he says that. The credentials issue, we don't challenge Mr. Sullivan's credentials to issue an accounting opinion. But he went further here, ultimately, on the motion for reconsideration when he tried to kind of rewrite the report and backtrack and find some explanations for what he did. And he came up with opinions that he is clearly not qualified to give, and Judge Edelman correctly noted that, which is business projections for businesses of this type, and that the management changes did have this effect on the business, where suddenly it went from a negative 4.79% growth rate to a 7.76% growth rate. And he says, well, it was because of the management changes, and that's what the management told me. Those sorts of actions by experts have been frowned upon by this court repeatedly, for the witness not taking his own stand in justifying what it is that he did. He did no economic analysis of the factors that affected the revenues. He never demonstrated that the growth rate that he chose was in any way related to the management changes. And the bottom line is that he didn't use any reliable methodology at all in any aspect of the business interruption calculation that he did. And if you look at his deposition testimony, all he says is, that's the way that I've always done it. He was asked repeatedly, what principle did you follow? What accounting principle or guideline did you follow? Is there something out there? And his answer was, every single time, without fail, none that I can think of. So the fact that he's done it this way all the time is not a principled methodology, and it should not be countenanced by this court. And finally, Mr. Vickers has said in the briefs and then again to this panel that our expert, Clifton Lewis, did the same thing. Well, there is absolutely no evidence in the record that Mr. Lewis ever validated what Mr. Sullivan did or repeated it or mimicked it or did anything. Mr. Lewis never replicated Mr. Sullivan's results using the same data and methods. What he did was he created a chart in his critique of Mr. Sullivan's report, which basically plugged in the data that Mr. Sullivan came up with as a means to compare it to the data, to the results that Manpower's prior expert came up with, and also to chart different scenarios. He never accepted them, he never accepted what he did, and he never countenanced it. Because Judge Adelman properly excluded Mr. Sullivan's report, which you, if you look at it, it is a bare-bones report that would be completely unhelpful to the trier of fact. He takes bare-bones conclusions that have no support anywhere, and even when he was questioned at his deposition for why he reached certain conclusions, he still couldn't come up with an explanation. And again, it was only on the motion for reconsideration that he decided to stick in extra charts and, okay, now let me explain to you what I did. And Judge Adelman, who was under no obligation under the law to consider that, did give it some airtime and said, even now you're being arbitrary, and why are you throwing in these trend periods, and why these base periods? They were so arbitrary, and there was no explanation for why Mr. Sullivan did what he did. And there was still no explanation for why the five-month period just prior to the loss was a good indicator of what Manpower's performance would be. Following Seventh Circuit precedent in Zenith, in other cases, Judge Adelman properly held that Mr. Sullivan's opinions were not the product of any reliable principles and methodologies, and he did not abuse his discretion either in precluding Mr. Sullivan's report in its initial variation and or as it was embellished improperly, I might add, on the motion for reconsideration. Now, just briefly on, before I move on to the difference in conditions, does the panel have any further questions on the Daubert issues? With regard to the difference in conditions issue, Judge Adelman properly denied Manpower's motion for partial summary judgment on the third affirmative defense. The local policy is an all-risk policy. It covers theft unless theft is otherwise excluded. And by pointing to the theft exclusions as a way of illustrating that the policy does cover theft and theft does not typically involve damaged materials, the court was not creating coverage where coverage does not otherwise exist. That's not the right argument to make here. Manpower specifically asked Judge Adelman to take this on, and it didn't go their way. They tried to establish that as a matter of law, the only way you could interpret the local policy was to require that there be physical damage or destruction to the covered property. That's not what the local policy says. Judge Edelman properly found that Manpower did not meet its burden and properly granted summary judgment on the third affirmative defense. And since there was no difference in conditions, he correctly concluded that there were no further issues for him to decide because the furnishings claim was not covered under the master policy, and therefore his entry of final judgment was appropriate. Thank you.
I do have one other question on the Daubert. Footnote 2 of your brief seems to suggest that if we were to reverse on the Daubert issue, which would effectively invalidate the grant of summary judgment, that it would still be open to you then to basically raise the issue about the coverage under the policy that Judge Adelman had found that you withdrew your cross appeal on.
Right.
Why do you think that would be open to you to revisit, given that all interlocutory rulings are merged into the final judgment that's before this court?
You're speaking about the in the summary judgment granting ISOP's motion on the business interruption?
Yes. But Judge Edelman had previously found that there was coverage, there was business interruption coverage under the master policy, right?
Yes. He found that.
That was the subject of your cross appeal, correct?
That was the subject of the cross appeal, which we withdrew because we were, I guess after some further research, we realized we were not aggrieved by it in this set of appeals, but that if the case went back and the business interruption matters were open again, we would then be aggrieved and we would have a basis to appeal his coverage decision on whether there's business interruption covered under the
master. And my question is, what's the basis for that, given that that was an interlocutory ruling? The doctrine is that all interlocutory rulings in a case are subsumed within the final judgment. The final judgment's here on appeal. Why wasn't it incumbent on you to maintain that cross appeal if you are seeking to challenge it?
which is why we made the cross appeal, but then we were told by the Seventh Circuit, or gently nudged by the Seventh Circuit, to withdraw it because we were not aggrieved. So that's what we did.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Vickers?
Two points I'd like to respond to, one on the Daubert issue and one on the local policy issue. Counsel referenced Mr. Lewis's report and the fact that he has this chart in there that looked at different scenarios. There's actually 22, if my memory serves me correct, different scenarios that he looked at and came up with a business interruption number for. What's important about that chart and why we reference it is the Daubert factor of, can the results be replicated? Can somebody else using the same methodology replicate the results? And what's important about what Mr. Lewis did is if you look at the data points, the items that he looked at, they're the same for all 22 scenarios. He looks at a growth rate, he looks at a gross profit margin, and he looks at a period of interruption. And all he does on these different scenarios is use different growth rates, different period of interruption, or different gross profit margins, and then they spit out different numbers. That proves the point that the methodology is sound. And what this is really an attack on is the input, which this court has said in Smith v. Ford Motor and the Lapsey case and other courts, including the Florida court citing the 11th Circuit, has said is not the proper basis for a Daubert inquiry. That's the factual finding that's within the province of the trier of fact. That's why we cite to Mr. Lewis's chart that shows all these different scenarios, because the methodology he's applying to come up with 22 different estimates of the BI loss is the same methodology Mr. Sullivan used. He just uses different inputs. Now, with regard to the local policy issue,
Richard, your time expired. You may have another minute. I don't want to cut you off.
Thank you for pointing. All I want to say really quickly on that is the reason we took that issue on is that's the way this adjustment went. AIG in Europe denied the claim, replete with saying there's no material damage to your property. Manpower accepted that. That claim file got closed. We opened a claim file under the master policy, ultimately got a ruling by the court that there was coverage, and then the DIC issue got raised. With regard to why there's a difference in condition in those two policies, I've already addressed that. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Vickers. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.